Silence ensued, the sound of an opening refrigerator and the splash and glug of a tumbler being filled. A moment in which to down a soul-soothing quantity of wine. I could smell it, cheap Chablis from a box, probably, and Nurse Duff returned to the living room bearing a glass the approximate size of a paint can, turned on the giant TV, and plopped down on the sofa, settling into its cushions like a punctured parade float. How she had failed to notice me behind the coat tree, I couldn't guess, except to say that my new condition had afforded me the ability to stand with a stillness that functioned as a kind of camouflage, rendering me nearly invisible to the casual, world-weary eye. I watched her flick through various programs, a cop drama, the Weather Channel, a prison documentary, until she settled on a reality show about, what else? Competitive cupcake making. Her back was to me. Sip by sip, the wine went down. I guessed it wouldn't be long before the alcohol-anesthetized Nurse Duff began to snore. But with Dawn's blade sliding toward me, and my various needs pressing down, cash, an automobile, a safe place to wait out the daylight hours, I saw no reason for delay. I emerged from my concealment and stepped behind her. I did not kill her immediately. Again, I seek not pardon but patience with my tale. There was data to collect, and for that, Nurse Duff needed to be alive. A taste, and the deed was done. At once, the woman fell into a swoon, eyes rolled back, breath expelled, every inch gone flabbily slack. Like an eager groom, I picked her up and carried her to the bedroom, where I lay her on the comforter, then retreated to the bathroom and filled the tub. By the time I returned, the change had commenced. A white froth bubbled from her lips. Her fingers began to twitch, her hands. She began to moan, then grunt, then fell silent as a series of hard spasms shook her frame so violently I thought dear Nurse Duff would snap like a cracker. Then it happened. The closest visual approximation I can offer is a time-accelerated video of a flower breaking into blossom. With a cartilaginous crunch, her fingers commenced their elongation. Her hair suddenly detached from her skull and fell fan-like onto the pillow. As if doused by acid, her facial features blendified until no trace of personality remained. By this time her convulsions had ceased. Her eyes were closed, her face almost peaceful. I sat on the bed beside her, murmuring gentle encouragements. A green light had begun to emanate from her, bathing the room in a nursery soft glow. Her jaw unhinged. With something like a dog's sneeze, her teeth shot from her mouth like a handful of corn kernels, making way for the barricade of lances that ascended bloodily from her gums. It was ghastly. It was beautiful. She opened her eyes. For a long moment, she stared at me. What pathos in that gaze. We are, each of us, a character in our own story. That is how we make sense of our lives. But the woman who had been Nurse Duff, helpmaid to the sick and suffering, collector of quilts and butter churns, drinker of Mai Tais, margaritas and Bahama Mamas, daughter, sister, dreamer, healer, spinster, had become unknown to herself. She was a part of me now. An extension of my will. Had I desired, I could have made her hop on one foot while playing an invisible ukulele. You don't have to be afraid, I said, taking her hand in mine. It's all for the best. You'll see. Once again, I lifted her into my arms. My strength was such that her considerable bulk seemed toy-like. A memory came to me. I had carried a woman like this once. Though the circumstances were very different, she too had seemed to weigh almost nothing. The recollection aroused a feeling of tenderness so overwhelming that for a moment I doubted my actions. But there were things to learn, and the duty I was about to perform was, in its backhanded way, a kindness. I carted Nurse Duff to the bathroom and suspended her body above the tub. Through some lingering womanly instinct, she had looped her arms around my neck. She had yet to notice the water, as was my hope. I was gazing deep into her eyes, beaming thoughts of reassurance. Her trust in me was absolute. What was I to her? Father? Lover? Deliverer? God? The spell was broken the moment her body touched the water. She began to thrash wildly, fighting to free herself. But her strength was far outmatched by mine. Pressing her by the shoulders, I forced her gargoyle's face below the surface. Her panic and confusion rippled through me. What betrayal! What incomprehensible deceit! Others would have been moved to mercy, yet these feelings only strengthened my resolve. I felt her take the first breath of water. It ricocheted through her like a hiccup. She took a second, then a third, filling her lungs. A last agonal spasm, and she was gone. I stepped back. The first test had been passed. Here was the second. Waiting for the restoration of her human form, I counted off the seconds. When nothing happened, I hoisted her from the water and arranged her face down on the floor, thinking this might encourage the process. But more minutes ticked away, and I was forced to concede that no change was forthcoming. Nurse Duff had permanently departed from this life. I retreated from the room and sat on the woman's bed to ponder the situation. The only conclusion I could draw was that the transformative effect of death by water was for me alone, that my descendants possessed no such gift of resurrection. Yet why this should be so, why I should be sitting there looking altogether like the man I'd once been, while she should be lying dead on the bathroom floor like a beached sea monster, was beyond my power to explain. Was I simply a more robust version of our species, being the alpha, the original, the zero? Or could the difference be one not of body, but of mind? That I had wanted to live, while she had not. I considered my emotions. I didn't really have any. I had drowned an innocent woman in a bathtub, yet my feelings were utterly colorless. From the moment I'd sunk my incisors into the soft meat of her neck and taken the first candy-sweet sip, she had ceased to exist as an entity distinct from myself. Rather, she'd been a kind of appendage. Killing her had seemed no more morally noteworthy than trimming a fingernail. So perhaps that was where the difference lay. In the only way that really mattered, Nurse Duff was already dead when I'd shoved her in the water. Simultaneously, alarm bells were ringing inside me. The light in the room was changing. Daybreak, my nemesis, was at hand. I moved hastily through the house, drawing every drape and shade, locking doors both front and back. For the next 12 hours, I was going nowhere. I awoke in delicious darkness, having discovered the most refreshing, dream-free sleep I had ever known. No knock on the door had aroused me. Nurse Duff's departure from the world had yet to be noticed, though surely this would come. I made my preparations quickly. On America's byways, even a vampire, especially one who wishes to fly beneath the radar, needs money to get by. In a cat-shaped cookie jar, I discovered $2,300 in soft bills, more than enough, and a .38 revolver, which no person in the history of the planet needed less than I. My plan was to zigzag my way east, avoiding major highways. The journey would take 5, perhaps 6 nights. Nurse Duff's well-worn Corolla, with its detritus of candy wrappers, pop cans, and worthless scratch-offs, would suffice for the time being, but would have to be discarded soon. Somebody was bound to catch wind of the dead demon in the bathroom and note her missing automobile. I also felt and looked ridiculous in the woman's oversized sweatsuit and shower shoes. A more suitable costume was in the offing. 8 hours later, I was in southern Missouri, where I commenced the pattern that would organize my life for the duration. Each new daybreak found me safely ensconced in an off-brand motel behind closed drapes, duct-taped cardboard panels, and a do-not-disturb sign. Once night fell, I would set out again and drive without stopping until an hour or two before dawn. In Carbondale, Illinois, I decided to ditch the Corolla. I was also very hungry. I lingered at my hotel past dark, sitting in my parked car, so that I might observe the comings and goings of my fellow travelers and identify an appropriate provider of nutrition, clothes, and transport. The man I selected was my approximate height and weight. He also seemed, conveniently, inebriated. As he entered his room, I pushed in behind him, killed him tidily before he could utter more than a drunken whimper. He tasted rancidly of nicotine and bar-poor whiskey, wrapped his body in the shower curtain to conceal the stench of putrefaction, shoved him in the closet, helped myself to the contents of his wallet and suitcase. Dockers, no iron sports shirts of obnoxious plaid, 6 sets of underpants, and a pair of novelty boxers with the words, "Kiss me, I'm Irish," stenciled on the crotch, and skedaddled in his plushly appointed, thoroughly American sedan. The business cards in his wallet identified him as a regional sales manager for a manufacturer of industrial air circulation equipment. I might as well have been him. In this manner, I hunted and pecked my way across the great featureless slab of the American Middle West. As the nights and miles slithered by, road hypnosis cast my mind into the past. I thought of my parents, long dead, and the town where I was raised, a doppelganger to the many anonymous hamlets that I, king of destruction, passed through unremarkably, just a pair of headlights drifting downstream in the dark. I thought of people I'd known, friends I'd made, women I'd bedded. I thought of a table with flowers and crystal and a view of the sea, and a night, a sad and beautiful night, when in falling snow I had carried my beloved home. I thought of all these things, and many more besides. But most of all, I thought of Liz. The lights of New York rose from wretched New Jersey on the evening of the sixth day. 8 million souls. My senses were singing like a soprano. I entered Manhattan via the Lincoln Tunnel, abandoned the car on 8th Avenue, and set out on foot. I stopped in the first tavern I came to, an Irish pub with a heavily lacquered bar and sawdust on the floor. Among the patrons, nothing seemed out of the ordinary. Such is the insularity of New Yorkers that what was happening in the middle of the country had yet to coalesce into a feeling of general crisis. Seated alone at the bar, I ordered a scotch, not intending to drink it, but discovered that I wanted to, and more interestingly, that it caused no ill effects. It was delicious, its most subtle flavors dancing upon my palate. I was on my third when I realized two other things. I was not the least drunk, and I badly needed to piss. In the men's room, my body released a stream so powerfully percussive it made the porcelain chime. This, too, was immensely satisfying. It seemed there was no bodily pleasure that had not been amplified 100-fold. But the real object of my attention was the television above the bar. A Yankees game was on. I waited until the last pitch was thrown and asked the bartender if he would switch to CNN. I did not have to wait long. Colorado killing spree, read the chyron at the bottom of the screen. The madness was spreading. Reports were coming in from locales throughout the state. Whole families obliterated in their beds. Towns without a man or woman left alive, a roadside restaurant of patrons gutted like trout. But there were also survivors, bitten, but alive. It just looked at me. It wasn't human. It gave off this kind of glow. The ravings of the traumatized, or something more. No one had done the math yet, but I did. Per my instructions, for every 9 killed, 1 had been called into the fold. The hospitals were filling with the sick and injured. Nausea, fever, spasms. Then, there's some creepy shit. I turned to the man sitting next to me. When had the adjacent stool become occupied? A certain urban type. Manufactured by the thousands, balding and lawyerish, with an intelligent, slightly pugnacious face, a speckling of day-old beard, and a little paunch he kept meaning to do something about. Wingtips and a blue suit and starched white shirt, necktie loose around his throat. Somebody was waiting for him at home, but he couldn't quite bring himself to face them yet. Not after the day he'd just had. Don't I know it? On the bar before him sat a glass of wine. Our eyes met for what seemed an unusually long time. I noted the overwhelming odor of nervous perspiration he'd attempted to cloak with cologne. His eyes traveled the length of my torso, pausing at my mouth on the upswing. Haven't I seen you in here before? Ah, I thought. I darted my eyes around the room. There were no women at all. I don't think so. I'm new. Are you meeting anyone? Not until now. He smiled and put out his hand, the one without the wedding ring. I'm Scott. Let me buy you a drink. 30 minutes later, wearing his suit, I left him in an alleyway, twitching and frothing. I thought of visiting my old apartment, but discarded the idea. It was not, had never been home. What is home to a monster? To anyone? There exists for each of us a geographical fulcrum, a place so saturated with memory that within its precinct the past is always present. It was late, after 2 a.m., when I entered the main hall at Grand Central Terminal. The restaurants and shops had long since closed, sealed behind their grates. The board above the ticket windows listed only morning trains. Just a few souls lingered, the ubiquitous transit police in their Kevlar vests and creaking leather accoutrements, a couple in evening wear racing for a train that had long since departed, an old black man pushing a dust mop, earphones stuffed in his head. At the center of the marbled hall stood the information booth with its legendary timepiece. "Meet me at the kiosk, the one with the four-faced clock." It was New York's most celebrated rendezvous point, perhaps the most famous in the world. How many fateful encounters had occurred in this place? How many assignations had commenced? What nights of love? How many generations walked the earth because a man and a woman had arranged to meet here, beneath this storied timepiece of gleaming brass and opalescent glass? I tilted my face toward the barrel-vaulted ceiling, 125 feet overhead. In my young adulthood, its beauty had been muted by layers of coal, soot, and nicotine, but that was the old New York. A thorough cleaning in the late 90s had restored its gold-leaf astrological images to their original luster. Taurus, the bull. Gemini, the twins. Aquarius, bearing his water. A milky smear of galactic arm, as one sees only on the clearest of nights. A little known fact, though not unacknowledged by my scientist's eye, is that the ceiling of Grand Central is actually backward. It is a mirror image of the night sky. Lore holds that the artist was working from a medieval manuscript that showed the heavens not from within, but from without. Not mankind's view, but God's. I took a seat at the top of the west balcony steps. One of the transit cops gave me a quick eyeball, but as I was now dressed for the part of respectable, white-collar professional and was neither asleep nor visibly drunk, he left me alone. I took logistical stock of my surroundings. Grand Central was more than a train station. It was a principal nexus of the city's substrata, its vast underground world of tunnels and chambers. People by the hundreds of thousands flowed through this place each and every day, most never looking beyond the tips of their own shoes. It was perfect, in other words, for my purpose. I waited. The hours moved by, and then the days. No one seemed to notice me, or if they did, to care. Too much else was going on. And then, after some unknown interval of time had passed, I heard a sound I had not heard before. It was the sound that silence makes when there is no one left to listen. Night had fallen. I rose from my place on the steps and walked outside. There were no lights burning anywhere. The blackness was so complete I might have been at sea, miles from any shore. I looked up and beheld the most curious of sights. Stars by the hundreds, the thousands, the millions, locked in their slow turning above the empty world, as they had done since time's beginning. Their pins of light fell upon my face like pattering drops of rain, streaming out of the past. I did not know what I was feeling, only that I felt it. And I began, at last, to weep. 15. And thus to my woeful tale. Observe him, a capable young man of passable looks, slender and shaggy-haired, tanned from a summer of honest outdoor work, good with math and things mechanical, not without ambition and bright hopes, and possessing a solitary, inward-looking personality, alone in his bedroom beneath the eaves as he packs his suitcase of folded shirts and socks and underwear, and not much else. The year is 1989. Our setting is a provincial town named Mercy, Ohio, famous briefly for its precision brass works, said to produce the finest shell casings in the history of modern warfare, though that, like much else of the town, is long faded. The room, which is to be unoccupied within the hour, is a shrine to the young man's youth. Here is the display of trophies. Here are the soldier bedside lamp and matching martial-themed curtains. Here the shelves of serial novels featuring intrepid trios of underappreciated teenagers whose youthful intellects enable them to solve crimes their elders cannot. Here, tacked to the neutral plaster walls, are the pennants of sports teams and the conundrumous M.C. Escher etching of hands drawing each other, and opposite the sagging single bed, the era-appropriate poster of the erect-nippled Sports Illustrated swimsuit model, beneath whose lubricious limbs and come-hither gaze and barely concealed pudenda, the boy is furiously masturbated night after adolescent night. But the boy, he undertakes his packing with the puzzled solemnity of a mourner at a child's funeral, which is the scene's appropriate analogue. The problem is not that he cannot make his belongings fit. He can. But the opposite. The meagerness of the bag's contents seems mismatched with the grandeur of his destination. Tacked above his cramped little boy's desk, a letter gives the clue. Dear Timothy Fanning, it reads on elaborately decorated letterhead with a crimson, shield-shaped emblem and the ominous words, Veritas, bespeaking ancient wisdoms. Congratulations, and welcome to the Harvard class of 1993. It is early September. Outside, an earthbound, misting rain, tinged by summer's green, hugs the little hamlet of houses and yards and storefront commercial concerns, one of which belongs to the boy's father, the town's lone optometrist. This places the boy's family in the upper reaches of the town's constricted economics. They are, by the standards of that time and place, well off. His father is known and appreciated. He walks the streets of Mercy to a chorus of amiable hellos, because who is more admirable and worthy of gratitude than the man who has placed the spectacles upon your nose that enable you to see the things and people of your life? As a child, the boy loved to visit his father's office and try on all the eyeglasses that decorated the racks and display cases, longing for the day when he would need a pair of his own. Though he never did. His eyes were perfect. Time to go, son. His father has appeared in the door, a short, barrel-chested man whose gray flannel trousers, by gravitational necessity, are held aloft by clip-on suspenders. His thinning hair is wet from the shower, his cheeks freshly scraped by the old-fashioned safety razor he favors, despite modern innovations in shaving technology. The air around him sings with the smell of Old Spice. If you forget anything, we can always send it to you. Like what? His father shrugs amiably. He is trying to be helpful. I don't know. Clothes? Shoes? Did you take your certificate? I'm sure you'll want that. He is speaking of the boy's second-place award in the Western Reserve District 5 Science Day competition. The spark of life, Gibbs, Donnan equilibrium, and Nernst potential at the critical origin of cell viability. The certificate, in a plain black frame, hangs on the wall above his desk. The truth is, it embarrasses him. Don't all Harvard students win first prize? Nevertheless, he makes a show of gratitude for being reminded and places it atop the pile of clothing in the open suitcase. Once in Cambridge, it will never make it out of his bureau drawer. 3 years later, he will discover it beneath a pile of miscellaneous papers, regard it with a quick, bitter feeling, and pitch it into the trash. That's the spirit, his father says. Show those Harvard smarties who they're dealing with. From the base of the stairs, his mother's voice ascends in an insistent song. Timothy, are you ready yet? She never calls him Tim. Always it is Timothy. The name embarrasses him. It feels both courtly and diminutive at the same time, as if he were a little English lord on a velvet cushion. Though he also secretly likes it. That his mother vastly prefers him to her husband is no secret. The reverse is also true. The boy loves her far more easily than he loves his father, whose emotional vocabulary is limited to manly pats on the back and the occasional boys-only camping trip. Like many only children, the boy is aware of his value in the household economy. And nowhere is this value more lofty than in his mother's eyes. My Timothy, she likes to say, as if there are others not hers. He is her only one. You are my special Timothy.
Harold, what are you doing up there? He's going to miss the bus.
For Pete's sake, just a minute. He returns his eyes to the boy. Honestly, I don't know what she's going to do without you to worry about. That woman's going to drive me crazy. A joke, the boy understands. But in his father's voice he detects an undertone of seriousness. For the first time he considers the full emotional dimensions of the day. His life is changing. But his parents' lives are changing too. Like a habitat abruptly deprived of a major species, the household will be wrenched into realignment by his departure. Like all young people, he has no idea who his parents really are. For 18 years he has experienced their existence only insofar as it is related to his own needs. Suddenly, his mind is full of questions. What do they talk about when he's not around? What secrets do they hold from each other? What aspirations have been left to languish? What private grievances, held in check by the shared project of child-rearing, will now in his absence lurch into the light? They love him. But do they love each other? Not as parents, or even husband and wife, but simply as people. As surely they must have loved each other at one time. He hasn't the foggiest. He can no more grasp these matters than he can imagine the world before he was alive. Compounding the difficulty is the fact that the boy has never been in love himself. Though the social patterns of Mercy, Ohio are such that even a modestly attractive person can find opportunities in the sexual marketplace, and the boy, although a virgin, has been from time to time its beneficiary. What he has experienced is merely love's painless presage, the expression without the soul. He wonders if this is a lack within himself. Is there a part of the brain from which love comes that in his case has drastically malfunctioned? The world is awash in love. On the radio, in movies, in the pages of novels. Romantic love is the common cultural narrative, yet he seems immune to it. Thus, though he has yet to taste the pain that comes with love, he has experienced pain of a different, related sort. The fear of facing a life without it. They meet the boy's mother in the kitchen. He expects to find her dressed and ready to go, but she is wearing her flowered housecoat and terry cloth slippers. Through some unspoken agreement, it has been determined that his father alone will accompany him to the station. "I packed you a lunch," she declares. She thrusts a paper sack into his hands. The boy unfolds the crinkled top, a peanut butter sandwich in waxed paper, cut carrots in a baggie, a pint of milk, a box of Barnum's animal crackers. He is 18. He could devour the contents of 10 such bags and still be hungry. It's a meal for a child. Yet he finds himself absurdly grateful for this small present. Who knows when his mother will make him lunch again? "Do you have enough money? Harold, did you give him any cash?" "I'm fine, Mom. I have plenty from the summer." His mother's eyes have begun to pool with tears. "Oh, I said I wouldn't do this." She waves her hands in front of her face. "Lorraine, I said, don't you dare cry." He steps into her warm embrace. She is a substantial woman, good to hug. He breathes in the smell of her, a dusty, fruit-sweet aroma tinged with the chemical scent of hairspray and the off-gassing nicotine of her breakfast cigarette. "You can let him go now, Laurie. We're going to be late."
"Harvard. My Timothy is going to Harvard. I just can't believe it."
The ride to the bus station in a neighboring town takes 30 minutes along rural highways. The car, a late-model Buick LeSabre with a soft suspension and seats of crushed velour, makes the roadway beneath them seem vague, as if they are levitating. It is his father's one self-indulgence. Every 2 years, a new LeSabre appears in the driveway, all but indistinguishable from the last. They pass the last houses and ease into the countryside. The fields are fat with corn. Birds wheel over the windbreaks. Here and there a farmhouse, some pristinely kept, others in disrepair. Paint flaking, foundations tipping, upholstered furniture on the porches and abandoned toys in the yards. Everything the boy sees touches his heart with fondness. "Listen," his father says, as they are approaching the station. "There's something I wanted to say to you." Here it comes, the boy thinks. This impending announcement, whatever it is the reason they've left his mother behind. What will it be? Not girls or sex. Apart from one awkward conversation when he was 13, the subject has never been raised. Study hard, keep your nose to the grindstone. But these things, too, have already been said. His father clears his throat. "I didn't want to say this before. Well, maybe I did. I probably should have. What I'm trying to say is that you're destined for big things, son. Great things. I've always known that about you."
"I'll do my best, I promise."
"I know you will. That's not really what I'm saying." His father hasn't looked at the boy once. "What I'm saying is, this isn't the place for you anymore." The remark is deeply unsettling. What can his father intend? "It doesn't mean we don't love you," the man continues. "Far from it. We only want what's best."
"I don't understand."
"The holidays, okay. It wouldn't make sense for you not to be here for Christmas. You know how your mother is. But otherwise, You're telling me you don't want me to come home? His father is speaking rapidly, his words not so much spoken as unleashed. You can call, of course, or we can call you. Every couple of weeks, say, or even once a month. The boy has no idea what to make of any of this. He also detects a note of falsehood in his father's words, a manufactured rigidity. It is as if he's reading them off a card. I don't believe what you're saying. I know this is probably hard to hear, but it really can't be helped. What do you mean it can't be helped? Why can't it be? His father draws a breath. Listen, you'll thank me later. Trust me on that, okay? You might not think so now, but you've got your whole life ahead of you. That's the point. That's not the goddamn point. Hey, let's watch the language. There's no reason for that kind of talk. Suddenly the boy is on the verge of tears. His departure has become a banishment. His father says nothing more, and the boy understands that a border has been reached. He'll get nothing more from the man. We only want what's best. You've got your whole life. Whatever his father is actually feeling lies hidden behind this barricade of clichés. Dry your tears, son. There's no reason to make a mountain out of a molehill.
What about Mom? Is this her idea, too?
His father hesitates. The boy detects a flash of pain on the man's face. A hint of something genuine. A deeper truth. But in the next instant, it's gone. You don't have to worry about her. She understands. The car has come to a halt. The boy looks up, amazed to discover that they've arrived at the station. Three bays, one with a bus awaiting. Passengers are filing aboard. You've got your ticket? Speechless, the boy nods. His father extends his hand. He feels like he's being fired from a job. When they shake, his father squeezes before he does, mashing his fingers together. The handshake is awkward and embarrassing. They're both relieved when it's over. Go on now, his father urges with false cheer. You don't want to miss your bus. There is no rescuing the moment. The boy gets out, still clutching his paper sack of lunch. It feels totemic, the last vestige of a childhood not so much departed as obliterated. He hoists his suitcase from the trunk and pauses to see if his father will emerge from the Buick. Perhaps in a gesture of last-minute conciliation, the man will carry his bag to the bus, even send him away with a hug. But no such thing happens. The boy advances to the bus, places his bag in one of the open bays, and takes his place in line.
Cleveland! The driver bellows. All aboard for Cleveland!
There is some confusion at the head of the line. A man has lost his ticket and is attempting to explain. While everyone waits for the matter to be sorted out, the woman just ahead of the boy turns toward him. She is maybe 60, with neatly pinned hair, shimmering blue eyes, and a bearing that strikes him as grand, even aristocratic. Someone who should be boarding an ocean liner, not a dirty motor coach. Now I bet a young man like you is off somewhere interesting, she says merrily. He doesn't feel like talking. Far from it. College, he explains, the word thick in his throat. When the woman doesn't respond, he adds, I'm going to Harvard. She reveals a smile of absurdly false teeth. How marvelous! A Harvard man! Your parents must be very proud. His turn comes. He hands his ticket to the driver, moves down the aisle, and selects a seat at the rear because it is as far away from the woman as possible. In Cleveland, he will change buses for New York. After a night sleeping on a hard bench in the Port Authority station, his suitcase tucked under his legs, he will catch the first bus to Boston, departing at 5 a.m. As the big diesel rumbles to life, he finally turns his face toward the window. The rain has returned, dotting the glass. The spot where his father parked is empty. As the bus backs away, he opens the bag in his lap. It's surprising how hungry he is. He tears into the sandwich. 6 bites, and it's gone. He downs the milk without removing the carton from his lips. The carrots are next, devoured in an instant. He barely tastes any of it. The point is simply to eat, to fill an empty space. When all else is done, he opens the little box of cookies, pausing to regard its colorful illustrations of caged circus creatures. The polar bear, the lion, the elephant, the gorilla. Barnum's animal crackers have been a staple of his childhood. Yet it is only now that he notices that the animals are not alone in their cages. Each is a mother with her baby. He places a cookie on his tongue and lets it melt, coating the walls of his mouth with its vanilla sweetness. Then another and another, until the box is empty. Then closes his eyes, waiting for sleep to come. Why do I relate this scene in the third person? I suppose because it's easier. I know my father meant well, but it took me many years to process the pain of his decree. I have forgiven him, of course, but absolution is not the same as understanding. His unreadable face, his casually declarative tone. All these years later, I still puzzle over the apparent ease with which he dispatched me from his life. It seems to me that one of the great rewards of raising a son would be the simple enjoyment of his company as he moves into the real business of adulthood. But having no son of my own, I can neither confirm nor deny this. So it was that I arrived at Harvard University in September 1989, the Soviet Union on the brink of collapse, the economy in a state of general decline, the national mood one of weary boredom with a decade of drift. Friendless, orphaned in all but name, with few possessions and no idea what would become of me. I had never set foot on the campus or, for that matter, traveled east of Pittsburgh. And after the past 24 hours in transit, my mind was in such a state that everything around me possessed an almost hallucinatory quality. From South Station, I took the T to Cambridge, my first ride on a subway, and ascended from the cigarette-strewn platform into the hubbub of Harvard Square. It appeared that the season had changed during my journey. Muggy summer had yielded to tart New England autumn, the sky so shockingly blue it was practically audible. In my jeans and slept-in t-shirt, I shivered as a dry breeze moved over me. The hour was just shy of noon, the square thick with people, all of them young, all apparently at perfect ease with their surroundings, moving purposefully in pairs or packs, the talk and laughter passing between them with the crisp assuredness of batons in a relay race. I had entered an alien realm, but this was home to them. My destination was a dormitory named Wigglesworth Hall, though reluctant to ask anyone for directions, I doubted they'd even stop to talk to me, and discovering that I was famished, I made my way up the block away from the square, looking for some place inexpensive to eat. I was to learn later that the restaurant I chose, Mr. and Mrs. Bartley's Burger Cottage, was a beloved Cambridge landmark. I stepped inside to an eye-watering assault of weaponized onion smoke and the roar of a crowd. Half the city appeared to have shoved itself into the cramped space, filling the long tables, everyone trying to talk over everybody else, including the cooks, who were shouting out their orders like quarterbacks calling signals. On the wall above the grill was an enormous blackboard bearing elaborate descriptions in colored chalk of the most off-puttingly garnished burgers I had ever heard of. Pineapple, blue cheese, fried egg.
Just you?
The man addressing me looked more like a wrestler than a waiter, a huge bearded fellow wearing an apron as stained as a butcher's. I nodded dumbly.
Singles at the counter only, he commanded. Grab a stool.
A place had just come free. As the waitress behind the counter whisked away the previous occupant's dirty plate, I slid my suitcase against the base of the counter and took a seat. It wasn't very comfortable, but at least my luggage was hidden from view. I took my map out of my pocket and began to look it over.
What'll you have, hon?
The waitress, a harried-looking older woman with sweat stains at the armpits of her Burger Cottage t-shirt, stood before me, pad and pencil poised.
A cheeseburger? Lettuce, tomato, onion, pickle, ketchup, mayo, mustard, Swiss, cheddar, provolone, American. What kind of bun, toasted or plain?
It was like trying to catch bullets from a machine gun. Everything, I guess.
You want four different kinds of cheese?
She had yet to lift her eyes from her pad.
I'll have to charge you extra.
I didn't mean that. Sorry, just the cheddar. Cheddar is fine.
Toasted or plain?
I'm sorry? Her eyes, weary with boredom, rose at last.
Do you want your bun toasted or plain?
Jesus, Margot, take it easy on the guy, will you? The voice had come from the man sitting to my right. I had studiously kept my eyes forward, but now I turned to look. He was tall, broad-shouldered, but not overtly muscular, with the sort of well-proportioned face that gives the impression of having been made more carefully than most people's. He was dressed in a rumpled Oxford shirt tucked into faded Levi's. A pair of sunglasses was perched on his head, held in place by the folds of his wavy brown hair. One ankle, his right, was propped on the opposite knee, showing a scuffed penny loafer without a sock. In the periphery of my vision, he had registered as a full-fledged adult, but I now saw that he couldn't have been more than a year or two older than I was. The difference was one not of age, but of bearing. Everything about him radiated an aura of belonging, that he was a scion of the tribe and fluent in its customs. He closed his book, placed it on the counter next to his empty coffee cup, and gave me a disarming smile that said, "Don't worry, I've got this." "The man wants a cheeseburger with the works, toasted bun, cheddar cheese. Fries with that, I think. How about a drink?" he asked me. Milk?
"And a milk." "No," he said, correcting himself. "A shake. Chocolate, no whip. Trust me."
The waitress looked at me doubtfully.
"Okay with you?"
The whole exchange had left me baffled. On the other hand, a shake did sound good, and I was in no mood to turn away a kindness.
"Sure.
Attaboy." My neighbor climbed down from his stool and tucked his book under his arm in a way that suggested all books should be carried in precisely this manner. I saw, but did not understand, the title, Principles of Existential Phenomenology.
"Margot here will take good care of you. The two of us go way back. She's been feeding me since I was in short pants."
"I liked you better then," Margot said.
"And you wouldn't be the first to say so. Now chop, chop. Our friend looks hungry."
The waitress left without another word. Their repartee suddenly became clear to me. Not the banter of friends, but something rather like a precocious nephew and his aunt.
"Thanks,"
I said to my companion.
"De nada.
Sometimes this place is like a big rudeness contest, but it's worth the hassle. So where did they put you?
I'm sorry?
What dorm? You're an incoming freshman, aren't you?
I was amazed.
How did you know that?
The powers of my mind. He tapped his temple, then laughed.
That, and the suitcase. So which is it? I hope they didn't put you in one of the union dorms. You want to be in a yard.
The distinction meant nothing to me. Some place called Wigglesworth.
My answer obviously pleased him. You're in luck, friend. You'll be right in the middle of the action. Of course, what qualifies as action around this place can be a little staid. It's usually people tearing their hair out at 4 a.m. over a problem set.
He gave my shoulder a manly clap.
Don't worry. Everybody feels a little lost at first.
I kinda get the feeling you didn't.
I'm what you'd call a special case. Harvard brat from birth. My father teaches in the philosophy department. I'd tell you who he is, but then you might feel you should take one of his courses out of gratitude, which would be, pardon me, a huge fucking mistake. The man's lectures are like a bullet to the brain. For the second time in as many days, I was to receive a handshake from a man who seemed to know more about my life than I did. Anyway, good luck. Out the door, take a left, go down a block to the gate. Wigglesworth is on your right. With that, he was gone. Only then did I realize that I had neglected to get his name. I hoped I might see him again, though not too soon, and that when I did, I could report that I had ably inserted myself into my new life. I also made a note that at the earliest opportunity I would go shopping for a white Oxford shirt and loafers. At least I could look the part. My cheeseburger and fries arrived, shimmering deliciously with grease, and beside it the promised chocolate shake, standing tall in an elegant 50s-era glass. It was more than a meal. It was an omen. I was so thankful that I might have said grace, and nearly did.
College days, Harvard days. The feeling of time itself changed in those early months, everything rushing past at a frenetic pace. My roommate was named Lucchesi. His first name was Frank, though neither I nor anyone I knew ever used it. We were friends of a sort, thrust together by circumstances. I had expected everyone at the college to be some version of the fellow I'd met at the Burger Cottage, with a quick-talking social intelligence and an aristocrat's knowledge of local practices. But in fact, Lucchesi was more typical. Weirdly smart, a graduate of the Bronx High School of Science, hardly the winner of any prizes for physical attractiveness or personal hygiene. His personality laden with tics. He had a big, soft body, like a poorly filled stuffed animal's, large, damp hands he had no idea what to do with, and the roving, wide-eyed gaze of a paranoiac, which I thought he might be. His wardrobe was a combination of a junior accountant's and a middle schooler's. He favored high-waisted pleated pants, heavy brown dress shoes, and t-shirts emblazoned with the emblem of the New York Yankees. Within 5 minutes of our meeting, he had explained to me that he had scored a perfect 1600 on his SATs, intended to double major in math and physics, could speak both Latin and ancient Greek, not just read, actually speak, and had once caught a home run launched from the bat of the great Reggie Jackson. I might have viewed his companionship as a burden, but I soon saw the advantages. Lucchesi made me appear well-adjusted by comparison, more confident and attractive than I actually was, and I won not a few sympathy points among my dormitory neighbors for putting up with him, as one might have for tending to a farty dog. The first night, we got drunk together. Just a week after our arrival, at one of the countless freshman keg parties that the administration seemed content to overlook,
He vomited so helplessly and at such extended duration that I spent the night making sure he didn't die. My goal was to be a biochemist, and I wasted no time. My course load was crushing, my only relief a distribution course in art history that required little more than sitting in the dark and looking at slides.